rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, extraordinary news today. Teresa Hines Carey, coming out and saying, you did not hear this, by the way, on the evening news last night, did you? I wonder why. Teresa Hines Carey coming out and saying the election of 2004 was hacked. Hacked. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Why is this not a major headline story? The wife of the presidential candidate. This is first reported in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. By the way, welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. Our website, if you want to drop into the live chat room that runs during the program, where I hang out during the breaks, just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It will get you in there. There's a plan in place for the billionaires. Bush economic plan. When will there be an economic plan for the rest of us? Last week, they took away our rights to have class action lawsuits, the things that brought us cars that don't explode on impact, and slowed down the tobacco company and they're marketing their deadly products to our children. They took that away from us last week. This week, it's bankruptcy. So if you get sick or somebody in your family gets cancer or has a heart attack or something, or if somebody is elderly, well, no, we can't even protect their home. Ted Kennedy, an amendment to let's protect. What's next? Will the Bush administration succeed at destroying the United Nations? A few of the things we're going to talk about in the 3 hours of our program today. But I want to start out. What is going on here with Teresa? First of all, it'll be fascinating to find out to what extent the right-wing cranks are going to even point this out. This is like wonderful. You would think that this would be wonderful fodder for the right-wingers. See, here's your litmus test. Here's your measurement of reality, as it were. You know, how nutty is this or how non-nutty is this? Because if, for example, Teresa Hines Carey had said that last week she saw a UFO, every talk show host, every white right-wing talk show host in the United States would be talking about it right now. See, I told you she was nuts, they would be saying. And it would be on and on and on. What's going on with Teresa? And it would be interesting to see. I have a feeling there's not going to be much discussion about this. Because they don't really want to talk about it. And why? Because she made a few telling points. This is reported first in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer yesterday. An article by Joel Connolly. She had apparently been out there recently at a lunch for Representative Adam Smith. She made a few comments. I'll just share with you straight up from Joel Connolly. I got it, Ira. Got it. Hines Carey is openly skeptical about results from November's election, particularly in sections of the country where optical scanners were used to record votes. You get this? Now, interestingly, I got an email from one of the Democratic groups today saying we must have nothing but optical scanners because they're more reliable because there's actually a paper trail. Little debate here going on. In any case, here's what she said, and I quote, two brothers own 80% of the machines used in the United States. Well, it's a little bit of a misstatement. One of the brothers is a vice president and the other is a president or something similar to that, CEO. Of, respectively, as I recall, ESNS and Diebold. They're not owners, they are officers. But in any case, she says, two brothers own 80% of the machines used in the United States. She identified both as hard right Republicans. She argued that it is, quote, very easy to hack into the mother machines. She must have seen Howard Dean when he was filling in for Tina Brown on Topic A with Tina Brown. On nationwide TV in 90 seconds, Howard Dean hacked into a Diebold central tabulator machine, the one that pulls all the votes together for an entire county or an entire state, hacked into it and changed the results of an election. Teresa said, "We in the United States are not a banana republic." She argued the Democrats should insist on accountability and transparency in how votes are tabulated. And she said, "I fear for 06. I don't trust it the way it is right now." Now, what kind of coverage do you think this story is going to get? Might it be just a little too close to the bone? Might it have something to do with, you know, it raises the question, of course. Why is it that the Republicans have fought so hard to get into many of the states? For example, Georgia, just before Max Cleland lost to Saxby Chambliss, when all the polls showed Saxby Chambliss losing to Max Cleland, why is it that they fought so hard to get absolutely paperless machines through the entire state of Georgia just in time for the 2002 election? That one seat being the one that determined whether the Senate was going to be in the hands of the Republicans or not. Oh, no, Hartman's sounding like a conspiracy nut. No, this is just these are the facts. Why? Why did the Republicans fight so hard for this? And why are they fighting so hard to prevent bills in the House of Representatives and the Senate put forward by Congressman Rush Holt and Bernie Sanders and over 100 co-sponsors, including Republicans, but not the Republican leadership in the House, and similar bills in the Senate that would require voting machines to produce a voter-verified paper ballot that can be used in an audit, that would mandate random inspections. Why have the Republican Party, why have they been so opposed to this? Unless they really and seriously have in mind single-party rule forever. And believe, like Joe Stalin did, that the only way to do this is to silence the voice of the people, of we the people. Could it be? Well, I don't know. It sure raises some flags for me. I got to say, it just raises some huge flags for me. 1-866-889-8894. Bob in Washington State on the line. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. Here's my question. When the Founding Fathers set up our government and the balance of powers was in their mind, did they ever write or refer to the potential danger that could result in an administration having the House and the Senate like they do now?
Well, actually, when the nation was founded, there were no political parties. And in fact, in 1787, which is when the Constitution was written, and it took them a year or so to get the thing ratified because, you know, 3/4 of the states had to ratify it. There was a campaign starting in 1787 put forward by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, who were, in a way, you could say, opponents. Hamilton was what today you would call a Republican slash conservative, and Madison was what you would call a Democrat slash liberal. But together, they were trying to sell the Constitution because they thought it was the best thing for the nation. It was better than the Articles of Confederation that we were operating under. And the sales job was a series of articles that they wrote under pseudonyms, but everybody knew who it was, in newspapers. There was some 80-some of them out of them published. And now we call these the Federalist Papers, but they were basically trying to sell the Constitution. And in one of them, as I recall, it was Federalist Number 10, Madison wrote this long screed about how we've got to be very careful not to have political parties form. He called them factions because they knew that because we didn't have proportional representation. Nobody had figured it out at that point. It wasn't until 1860 when John Stuart Mill wrote about proportional representation where, you know, if the Green Party gets 10% of the vote, then they get 10% of the seats in Parliament, for example. So what they knew was if more than two political parties emerged, you would end up with a situation where a minority of the people would end up electing whoever was going to be in charge. And we've seen that, you know, about more than half of the presidential elections, actually. That's exactly what happened. And so Madison was begging, literally begging people. You read Federalist Number 10, it's fascinating. Begging people, and there's a whole chapter about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Begging us not to form political parties just for this reason. Because they were concerned that if political parties were formed, then all sorts of mischief would happen. And, of course, within 3 years of the time the Constitution was ratified, political parties had emerged. And so, you know, the answer to your question in short form is they had not anticipated it. And to the extent that they saw that it might be coming down the road, it scared the heck out of them. But they didn't know what to do about it. This was the first time representative democracy had ever been tried in the 7,000-year history of modern, of what we call civilization. The democracy that they had in Greece 3,000 years ago was a pure democracy. It required 6,001 people to show up at, you know, to have a meeting in order to create a law. In other words, you had to have, you know, the majority of the people on, in this little island state. Well, you couldn't do that in a country where you had 13 states spread out over 1,000 miles. And so they had to come up with something else. So they just hadn't anticipated it.
What? Has, in a sense, the balance of power doesn't really exist when the situation is like it is now. Isn't that a gross imbalance?
Well, it is to some extent, yeah, and in fact, I've argued that we have seen some of the most successful administrations in this country have been where the Republican Party controls something and the Democratic Party controls something, and that, for example, the third administration of Roosevelt, where the Democrats basically controlled everything, I would agree with many of the Republicans that things were pushing too far, and the Roosevelt was pushing too far. And on the other hand, right now, we've got the Republicans controlling the whole thing, and I think we're pushing too far in the other direction. It's been where there is, as you say, a balance of power, as it were, that we've had each party keeps the worst impulses of the other in check, and that's a healthy thing. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, this filibuster, this rule in the Senate, this rule goes back to the Senate. Prior to 1917, the Senate was not elected by we the people. When the Constitution was first put together, folks like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton didn't trust the people. John Adams referred to folks like you and me as the rabble. And so the senators in the United States Senate were actually appointed by professional politicians in the states, by the governors or the legislators or in, you know, smoke-filled rooms. And in 1917, the Constitution was amended to provide for direct election of the Senate. And when that happened, and senators actually started showing up representing the people, they realized that there had to be some stronger protection for a minority party. And that's when they came up with this rule of if you can get 40 votes, then you can force discussion on a topic to continue, which is a filibuster.
Right.
And Frist wants to nuke that and do away with that. And if he does away with that, that'll be the end of any sort of minority representation. And that then you're going to have something very much like Mussolini had in Italy, Hitler in Germany, Franco in Spain. You're going to have single-party rule in the United States, and nobody can do anything about it. And it's not healthy for democracy. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. All we want is the truth. Why are the Republicans so opposed to audit trails and voting machines? Why? Why when they did the recount in Ohio did Ken Blackwell try and rig it? Why is Congressman Tom Feeney refusing to discuss whether or not he hired this guy Clint Curtis to hack voting machines in Volusia County, where some 10,000 votes for Al Gore just vanished overnight in 2000? What's going on? What might it be? Interesting question. Very interesting question. And how are things changing in Washington D.C. and just, you know, around the country? I got to tell you, this is remarkable. Here we have Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, he's a Democrat. He's pledged to veto tax increases because he believes his state can be managed more efficiently, notes the thinkprogress.org, the American Progress blog. Then yesterday, he unveils a plan to crack down on tax cheats and abusive tax shelters and loopholes in order to create a budget surplus and prevent tax increases in the future. So he's gonna crack down on big corporations and on billionaires. On the other hand, conservative Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, former President Bush's budget director. This is incredible. This is proposing a 29% income tax increase on his state's residents to deal with budget shortfalls. And let's hit the middle class, 29% increase. Yet at the same time, he's pushing a bill in the state legislature that will waive unpaid interest, penalties, and fees accrued by wealthy tax cheats. You know, tell me what that's about. Go figure, right? Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Willie in South Carolina on the line. Oh, wait a second. Hang on. That's not Willie. That's Willie right there, I believe. Hey, Willie, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I was listening to you yesterday, and I did call my senator. And I felt good about it. I don't know if it did any good, but I did call. I guess my question is, you have to listen to you talk about, you know, how they're flooding the voting precincts with these machines, these D-Vote machines. They have the Congress. Well, I mean, what can I do? Well, as just an individual citizen, what can I do that's going to be productive? Because we got this election coming up in 2006, and I don't want to go into that year feeling like, okay, this is just hopeless.
Yeah, I agree. And what we need to be doing, this is another issue to be calling your senators and your members of Congress about. It's an issue to be writing letters to the editor about. It's an issue to be talking to your friends about. I mean, we need to get the buzz going is the bottom line. It's the same way that the right-wingers have, you know, done everything that they've done, from bringing down Dan Rather to, you know, with his phony memos to... It's just, you just keep talking, keep spreading the word. If you do that, you get this thought virus going, you get people talking about it, and pretty soon somebody has to do something. So
I appreciate it, babe. You keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you. You too, Willie. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Ira, you got to let me know who's on line one. And in the meantime, we'll go to John in Pennsylvania on line three here. Hey, John, what's up? I think. Maybe that's not John in Pennsylvania. If it's not, I'm going to put you back on hold here, whoever that was. Ira, go for it. Okay, Paul in Detroit is on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Paul calling. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First time caller, long time listener.
Thank you.
I just want to you take a look at the history of what's going on with, you know, the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine under Reagan. This is a long process that's going on, and what we have to do as a nation is to understand that this isn't a conspiracy theory. I mean, it's only just common sense that says to you, why would you let an election take place where not only can the vote be rigged, but you can't trace it?
Yeah, I think it's just a reasonable question. I don't think it requires a conspiracy nut to ask that. I mean, if the banks started refusing to give you receipts when you got money from your ATM, wouldn't you wonder what's going on with this? I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. Good point.
Really want to thank you for bringing it up. This
sure.
is something that I've been looking at for a long time.
Tag your it. Pass it along, okay? Paul,
okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Spread the word. 29 minutes past the hour.
But, Dad.
Tyler, we've been over this three times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No party for you.
But the whole class is invited.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy. But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
You were so stubborn.
Well, now you know where you got it from.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com.
Paid for by Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now you can say that I've grown bitter, but of this you may be sure. The rich have got their channels in the bedrooms of the poor, and there's a mighty judgment coming.
Oh boy, in 2006.
I may be wrong.
No, I don't think so. 2006. Thank you, Leonard.
You see, I hear these funny voices in the Tower of Song.
Yeah, I'm hearing the funny voices of electronic voting machines that are absolutely unaccountable, that are owned by hard right-wing corporations, to quote Teresa Hines Carey, of all people. Go figure. Let's try John in Pennsylvania one more time. John, hopefully you're listening to the phone,
John,
instead of the radio this time. How you doing?
Pretty good. Three things. First of all, I don't know, do you give a lot of credence to that announcement that Al Gore is not running?
I think that Al Gore's time has come and gone. As much as I admire him, I'd vote for him in a heartbeat. I think he's a great guy. I think he'd be a wonderful candidate. There is something to be said for, you know, the whole political notion of your moment in the sun and then after that. Although, you know, on the other hand, it wouldn't surprise me if Joe Biden were to run, and he's
just way down. Gore just strikes me in 2008 as the sure winner over Hillary, if he were to give it a serious shot.
I think he'd make a heck of a candidate. I think he'd make a very good candidate.
Yeah. The second thing is about, you were saying about that shifting of taxes. A local municipal tax went up on my employees, and they were all grumbling about it. And I said, well, where do you think this came from? You know, it's just a chain reaction. Taxes get cut on a federal level. States then have less money. Then municipal has less money. And they're the ones in the end that have to increase the taxes. And they're just baffled by the whole process. So taxes don't get cut, they get shifted. And I got a little giggle out of that one. The last one is it's about what you've been talking about the voting machines, and I lumped the bankruptcy tax that or the bankruptcy bill that came out. I lumped them all together. I mean, does the Democratic Party, or does either party, have a means of trying to get the message out? You there, Tom?
Yeah, I'm here.
Do they have a means of not controlling message, but of getting messages out and getting people talking about issues that maybe the president is avoiding and then the media avoids?
By and large, no.
This voting machine.
You know, people say, for example, I've had a couple of people call the program in the last week or two and say, you know, why isn't Howard Dean more visible and more out there? He's holding press conferences almost every day. It's just that by and large, they're not being covered. You have to keep in mind the media in the United States, as much as the cons like to vilify them, the media in the United States, by and large, is owned by a half a dozen or a dozen, if you include all the magazines, about a dozen large multinational corporations, several of which are heavily invested in the defense industry. And you know, they have a vested interest in stake here. And in fact, one of the things that Howard Dean had said on Chris Matthews' Hardball show back when he was running in the primaries was that he would break up the media monopoly if he ever became president. And that's, in my opinion, that's why he never got favorable press after that day. I mean, it was like that day a switch was thrown. And from that day forward, the press did nothing but make fun of him.
Yeah. And Democratic pollsters don't have a means of getting to the voters, showing this issue resonates, get on this and get the media to cover this, or things like that, because these things would seem to be matter to a lot of people on both sides and show a genuine interest in good government.
I really think what it's going to take, what it's absolutely going to take, John, is it's going to take folks like you and me and listeners to this program and the listeners to other progressive radio programs to be speaking out more and more loudly, more visibly, more noticeably, whatever, to getting more active in this until we just can't be ignored anymore. I mean,
we're not on TV.
Well, see, but the fact of the matter is that conservatives for a long time felt on the outside, and what did they do? They organized, they got active, and they started speaking out, and they put together think tanks, and they started, and they mobilized the base. We have to do the same thing. It's just that simple. The Democrats have been taking for granted their constituency. And poof, the Republicans got control of it. Yeah, by hook or crook. And I think there was a fair amount of crook in there. But nonetheless, by hook or crook, the Republicans got control of it. And now it's time for us to do something about it. John, I got to move along. But thanks for the call. Good points
thanks,
you made.
Tom.
I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Chip in Florida on the line. Hey, Chip, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You guys just finished with a very important point about the fact that we don't really have a whole lot of voice on television.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I actually moved from Baltimore to Orlando to work on the presidential race, going door to door and getting a feel for what individual people were thinking and feeling about, politics in general. And it was fascinating to me to see how few people were really engaged as I went door to door.
Yeah.
And they may not have a hot button issue, one or the other, but for the most part, most people, the average person, isn't inclined to do things like you suggest, which I think are good suggestions. But most people, quite frankly, want to do their own little thing, protect their family, you know, go through their daily routine, go to their job, maybe go to the gym if they're lucky enough to have the motivation. But outside of that, it takes a lot to get the average person off the block, but they do watch a lot of television.
Well, you know, back in the 17th century, Sir Edmund Burke, when you know the founder of conservative thought, when he suggested that people like hairdressers and tallow makers, candle makers, should not be allowed to vote because that would do violence to society, he also suggested that basically what was conventional wisdom from the Roman time, that if you want to keep the populace from rising up, you have to make sure that they have enough bread, you know, that they have enough food. I mean, this is the great lesson of the French Revolution, if nothing else, that they have enough food and that they're entertained. Well, the Romans called it bread and circus. And if you keep people entertained and you keep them fed and you keep them working hard, there's got to be a certain level of what Alan Greenspan calls worker insecurity. I would say perhaps worker desperation. If you keep those three things going, you can keep people deflected from serious political discussion and serious political debate. And instead, they're just, you know, frantically trying to get to the second job so they can make enough money so that their kids can make it through school. You know, that's what's happening. And so the evisceration, the destruction of the middle class in the United States that began under Ronald Reagan when he declared war on organized labor in 1980, and these cons now have taken us from 35% of the American workforce unionized in the 40s, 25% when Reagan came into office, down to 7.9% right now of the private workforce. This war on the middle class has worked tremendously to their benefit because people are so busy and so concerned about simply making a living and getting by that they don't have time to pay attention to the stuff, you know, to the man behind the screen, as it were, you know, to the real machine that is not only destroying the American lifestyle, but also seizing power in this country. And there's very few people talking about this. Lou Dobbs, who's a Republican, overtly a Republican, an old-style Barry Goldwater, Nelson Rockefeller Republican. Lou Dobbs is the only guy on TV talking about this. Keith Olbermann occasionally gets on it, you know, and these are on cable networks. They're not. None of this is, of course, on the mainstream network news. You know, they're not going to go near these topics.
Yeah, it's tremendously frustrating to sit back and watch this occur, but I do gather most people are busy trying to take care of their affairs. On a quick side note, I'm actually at the VA hospital in Tampa, Florida right now, getting ready to go in and experience that process. I've been at it now for about 7 months as a Gulf War vet.
Mm-hmm.
And I must tell you that while I'm for national health care, I hope it does not take the shape of the VA medical system.
Well, you know, the VA medical system is very different from, for example, Medicare, in that the VA system is truly socialized medicine, meaning that the government actually owns the system and the people who work in it are employees of the government. Whereas with Medicare, you have a private system. You can go to your own, any doctor you choose or any doctor that takes Medicare payments, and you can go to a hospital and all that kind of, and Medicare simply pays the bills. So Medicare is what's called a single payer system, and that's how it works in, for example, Germany. And the VA hospital is closer to what you would call socialized medicine, which is more or less how it works in England. And you're pointing out the difference between the two, and I don't think the average American realizes that there are these two systems, and different countries employ different ones of the two. And I agree with you. I don't think that the government is the best provider of healthcare services, but I think it's best that the government pay for them, because if you have a single payer system, you're going to have the greatest efficiency. Right now, you have insurance companies charging us anywhere from 15 to as much as 30%. You know, just skimming it off the top, just to pay the bills,
right,
just for the administration.
It's really inefficient the way they work it. And, Tom, right. I want to finally just say that I read your We the People book, and I thought it was fantastic, and I would recommend everybody listening to grab a copy of it.
Well, thank you, Chip. I appreciate it.
Day.
Thanks for the plug. Hey, you too, and good luck at the VA there. I do appreciate the call. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rick in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, good day to you, Tom. I was listening to what you were saying there about maybe some of the most successful presidential administrations when we had divided power, that is when the president was of one party and the Congress another.
Yeah.
And I hearken back to the Eisenhower years when, except for the first 2 years of President Eisenhower's administration, the Democrats were in control. And, of course, now President Eisenhower himself was from Texas. Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House, was from Texas, and Lyndon Johnson the majority leader in the Senate was from Texas. So maybe they just were all getting along as Texans, but they were doing what was good for America. And the interesting thing about President Eisenhower, he is the last Republican that the New York Times endorsed for president.
Yeah, well, Eisenhower referred to himself as a liberal, you'll keep in mind.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but
no, I'm serious. He did.
Well,
he referred to himself.
Fine with me. He's the best president of my lifetime.
I thought he was. By and large, he was an excellent president.
And also,
in fact, you know how he campaigned in '52. His campaign was. I've got a video clip of this. You can find it on the web of his TV ads. And the TV ad, it was in black and white back then. Sure. And the TV ad, there's a stage, like a theater stage, you know, where the curtain goes up, and then you see this elephant coming across the stage, and he's got a big circus bass drum in front of him, you know, with the kind that hooks over your shoulders, and he's
right.
beating the drum. And on the drum is a single word, five letters, peace. And the voiceover says, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. That was his campaign commercial.
8 years he was in office, and we didn't lose a single person in military action. And here's a list of people who voted for Mr. Eisenhower, not in 52, but in 56. Now, listen to this. Martin Luther King, Jackie Robinson, who in all fairness was a Republican, Ralph Abernathy, and Robert Kennedy, whose brother ran for the vice presidential or tried to become the vice president on the other ticket. I mean, this is the kind of bipartisan support this man had. And he also made a comment when he first came in.
You're talking about Eisenhower now?
Yes, because when he first came in 53, the Republicans thought, oh, good, now we can get rid of the New Deal. President Eisenhower said, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember his exact words, he says, I am not going to repeal the New Deal, and anybody who tries to do so is a fool. Well, apparently these modern-day Republicans don't think so.
Yeah.
Now they're tinkering with Social Security, which, of course, was the cornerstone of what Roosevelt was trying to do. And what Roosevelt did, as you know, I'm sure, he actually saved capitalism. He was no socialist. Had Roosevelt not done what he did, we probably would have had a socialist revolution in this country.
Yeah, it would have been a terrible mess. And Eisenhower knew that. He was very clear about that. And, just very clear about it. And
who was it that said those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it? Was that George Bernard Shaw or was that George Santayana? I always get confused.
I think it's Santayana, but I'm frankly not sure.
But these modern-day Republicans, I guess they just don't learn.
Well, that's a compliment. The flip side of it may be that they learn very well, and not necessarily from our history, but from the history of others. For example, reading The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, or looking at how Joe Stalin instituted single-party rule in the Soviet Union, or looking at what the Benito Mussolini did. You know,
right, but I would hope those aren't the people they're looking to, but maybe they are.
One never knows.
Have a good day, Tom.
Thanks, Rick. Speaking of Eisenhower, let's just hear just for old times' sake, Mr. Eisenhower.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Yeah. 1-866-889-8894. In fact, Joseph... I won't give out his last name. Anyhow, Joseph emails me. He says, in 1983, because I had mentioned in 83, there's that videotape of Rummy over there shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. He says, Rummy was not Secretary of Defense. He had been during the Ford administration, though. Caspar Weinberger was in the Reagan administration. He was instead a private citizen who was appointed on an ambassadorial mission by Reagan. This private citizen, however, was head of an agri-pharmaceutical company that produced, among other things, the type of gases used on the Kurds. So, he says, if you're looking, Joe, if you're looking for the 1983 intersection of poisonous gas, the U.S. military, and Saddam, it's Rumsfeld. And my recollection is that he was the chairman of Searle Corporation, and he's the guy who brought us aspartame. But I may be wrong on that, but I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I'm spot on that. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Craig in Illinois on the line. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show. Check into your website every day. Love your writings, especially about ADHD.
Well, thank you.
But the point I wanted to make was in regard to the Social Security issue and the fact that basically Republicans, the right, conservatives, base most of this on their ideas of a free market economy, from what I understand.
Well, what they call a free market economy.
Yes, and I have several Republican friends that I debate these issues with periodically, and when they bring this up, I have a question that I ask them that makes them stop in their tracks and stare with disbelief or not understanding what I'm talking about, which is that, first off, a free market economy is a utopian ideal as far as I'm concerned. But more than that, I've not seen anybody ask this question in the liberal press or you may have covered it, I don't know, which is that when they bring this up, I ask my Republican friends, please tell me the difference between a free market economy and a black market economy, which we already have.
Right.
And everything that they describe in regard to free market economy basically describes a black market economy. No regulation, a Darwinian view, Darwinian economics, right down the line. So
you're right. There's one, with one single exception, and that is that the black market uses some of the things that we pay for. For example, our currency, a stable currency that we pay for to have. The black market makes use of that, and yet doesn't contribute through taxes to the sustaining of that, which is one of the reasons why we call it the black market. But good point. Excellent
point. Well, in a free market economy, they're against taxes.
Yeah. So, or they say they are.
Yes, they say they are. But
they want to be sure that the middle class are paying their taxes.
Exactly.
So you bet on that. Craig, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So long, honey dear, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well.
Well, let's see, in January it was 15,214,663,387. That's what we paid in interest on the debt George W. is running up.
My precious time. Don't think twice. It's all right.
In February, it was $15,888,878,064.20. In interest on the national debt that George W. ran up by borrowing from our children so that he could give tax cuts to his wealthy buddies. 1-866-889-8894. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great, what's up?
Oh, I just wanted to make a point or actually ask a question. You're often talking about how Bush is putting the squeeze on the middle class and maybe even trying to eliminate it. And couldn't you make like a pro-corporation argument about why the middle class should have money and exist? I mean, doesn't certain retail corporations depend on a strong middle class?
Well, what's happened is that the retail sector has shifted to a bipolar sector. Basically, those companies that are the bottom feeders, like Walmart, that serve the lowest end of the American socioeconomic group, are making out like bandits. And those in the top end, the Tiffany's of the world, are making out very well. The people that are going out of business, who are going out of business, and why you're seeing this huge consolidation, for example, with Federated department stores, where they're taking, you know, they want to take Macy's and all these other kind of midline stores and just lump them all together and either move them up or move them down, presumably move them down, is because the middle class is going away. And you could argue that it would be a good thing for America to have a strong middle class, because then there would be consumers to buy things. But see, that would require that the companies that are pushing for economic policy really care about there being markets in the United States. Right now, they're looking at China. I mean, you got the president of GE saying 60% of their growth is going to be in Asia.
Yeah, but doesn't Walmart even benefit from a good middle class?
They benefit the most from people who are so freaked out about price that they'll go wherever the price is cheapest, regardless of where things are made. That's the benefit to Walmart. Plus, Walmart's greatest expansion right now is outside the United States. Again, I'm telling you, these companies, their loyalty to the United States is thin to none.
Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks for the explanation.
Thanks for the call, Logan. Good to hear from you. Sorry to be depressing, but this is where it's at. Ah, me. Hey, I'm Tom Hartman. our program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank, the RNC, or some multinational corporation that happens to have bought a television network or a few thousand radio stations.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings. Welcome back, my friends. Greetings back.
Yes.
Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, streaming 24/7 on the Tom Hartman channel. We're on WhiteRoseSociety.org, American FM on Live 365, and on. I got my headphones untangled from my glasses here, a brand new experiment. And there we go. Last night, Louise and I had dinner with some friends here in Vermont, and Hal is the director of the Community Action Program in Montpelier. And we were talking, first of all, we were talking about how the Bush administration is trying to zero out a good chunk of his budget. That's a whole other discussion. But anyway, he said, you know, there's a lot in the media about how George Bush's policies in Iraq are leading to democracy in the Middle East. What do you think about this? And it's just, it's such a common thing. There's so many people talking about this. The spinmeisters have been working this so brilliantly. It's called getting out in front of an issue. It's like, for example, if you knew that because there had been a certain pattern of little micro earthquakes along the San Andreas Fault, you knew that within the next week there was going to be a big earthquake in the San Andreas Fault. You went on national TV and you said, I think there's going to be an earthquake in the San Andreas Fault. We better do something about it. And then it happened. Everybody go, holy cow, what is he? That's an imperfect example. A better one would be if the CIA was to tell you repeatedly that the Soviet Union was tottering and that East Germany was about to go down. I mean, literally any day now, East Germany was about to go down. And so you flew over to Germany and you stood in front of the wall and you said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, after you already had private discussions with him and knew that that pretty much was what was going to happen. It would look like you had made it happen. Even though what really made it happen was the fact that in East Germany, they could see West German TV. The economy was imploding. The Soviet Union was falling apart. Everybody saw it coming. So Reagan and his performance spinners said, we got to get out there and speak about this quickly, make it look like we're in charge of this thing. And the reality is that what's going on in the Middle East, you had Yasser Arafat died. Yasser Arafat was himself one of the major impediments to peace between Israel and the Palestinians. He died. It was probably the most significant event in the Middle East. And then you had the elections in the Ukraine, which followed elections during the Carter administration, or during the, what's his name there? Bill Clinton, the guy who just had surgery. During the Clinton administration, where we had elections in Serbia, you had elections in Belarus, and you had elections in the Soviet Republic of Georgia, and now here we had elections in the Ukraine, and in all four of those countries, in the elections, the local power brokers, the local government, seemed to win, according to the official vote, but by the exit polls, they lost. And in three of those four countries, a pro-democracy movement rose up and was willing to take back control of the government. In the most recent one, of course, being the Ukraine, everybody's familiar with. But it happened also in Belarus. It was unsuccessful there. It happened in Serbia. It happened in the Soviet Republic of Georgia. And now we're seeing this thing happening in Lebanon. Although, today, yesterday, we saw the backlash because Hezbollah is a significant social force, sort of like, you know, the IRA, or they have become, you know, they're running schools, they're running hospitals, they're doing what are perceived by the local folks, a lot of good stuff. So even though they have a history as a terrorist organization, I mean, keep in mind, Menachem Begin, who was the prime minister of Israel, blew up the King David Hotel when he was a terrorist. So it's which is not to criticize him either. The point is that nationalists, freedom fighters, George Washington was called a terrorist by the Brits, very often end up, you know, on the other side. So, and this is not to defend Hezbollah, because if they're still sponsoring suicide bombers, I have no use for them. And I'm assuming that they do. So, but the point is that the Bush administration is claiming credit for all this stuff, and they're saying that it had to do with Iraq. It had nothing to do with Iraq. And to the extent that there was any positive fallout from Iraq, it wasn't the Bush administration. You know, if they did something good, I'd be the first to give them credit. I really would. This is not my team, your team. Call up and tell me something good that George Bush did, and I'll salute him for it. You know, as I asked Tom Tancredo when he was on this program a year and a half ago, name for me one piece of legislation which was sponsored by the Republicans and signed into law by George W. Bush, whose primary beneficiary was we the people rather than the corporation. And, you know, I'll give you a free copy of any one of my books. I absolutely salute. I'll run that flag up the flagpole. I'll salute it. Just as I'm perfectly willing to criticize Bill Clinton for selling us down the tubes with trade and with the Telecommunications Act of 96, I'm perfectly willing to congratulate George W. Bush if he did something right. I haven't seen anything yet, but I mean that seriously. For my conservative listeners, give me a call. But anyhow, the Center for American Progress did a really nice job on this. The recent positive democratic developments in the Middle East have prompted pundits to ask, was President Bush right? The clear, emphatic answer on Iraq, on the war on terror, and on democracy promotion is no. As President Bush stated yesterday in a speech to the National Defense University, quote, a thaw has begun, end quote, in the broader Middle East, and that is undeniably a good thing. But many of the recent reforms have occurred despite, rather than because of, the administration's policies. Notwithstanding, during the past several weeks, the right wing has attempted to twist the latest Mideast developments into a vindication of the last 4 years of the administration's reckless policies. Only through tortured exaggerations and revisionist history is President Bush transformed into the prime catalyst of Middle Eastern democracy. So let's set the record straight. Number one, what role did Iraq's elections play? The elections in Iraq were a tremendous victory for the Iraqis, notes the Progress Report, as Christy Harvey, Judd Legume, and Jonathan Baskin. A tremendous victory for the Iraqis. However, remember that the White House, quote, resisted the idea of holding elections in January and only succumbed under pressure from Iraq's most powerful cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. As Iraqi expert Juan Cole charges, it was Sistani who demanded one-man, one-vote elections. So to the extent it's a victory for Iraqis. You'll recall George Bush wanted to have caucuses like they have in Iowa. Only the only people who could show up for the caucuses to decide who was going to be in the government were going to be handpicked by Paul Bremer. That was our plan. And Sistani got people out on the streets and said, no, you're going to have elections. And George Bush was forced to go along with it. But moreover, in most of the Mideast countries now experiencing signs of democracy, notes the Progress Report, it was a traumatic domestic event in Lebanon, the assassination of the former prime minister in the Palestinian territories, the death of Yasser Arafat, that triggered the initial reforms. And then they talk about democracy and terrorism. President Bush's stated democratization goals in the Middle East have been undermined by a misguided strategy to combat terrorism. 2 months ago, the National Intelligence Council, this is affiliated with the CIA, issued a report, and I quote, Iraq has replaced Afghanistan as the training ground for the next generation of professional terrorists. Now, does that sound to you like, you know, we're solving the terrorism problem? Not quite to me. And in fact, the official report, an official associated report, said that the best scenario that some of the jihadists who were not killed there will, in a sense, go home wherever home is and will therefore disperse to various other countries. As Richard Clark points out, this isn't a cure for terrorism. In fact, it's a growing resentment is breeding terrorism. Clark states, but it is chiefly resentment of us, not the absence of democracy. So we're actually making things worse. I mean, this is stuff that's happening in spite of us. They're looking at the example of the Ukraine. And Arafat's death, you know, created some space for this. While acknowledging and supporting positive developments in the Middle East, it's also important to be realistic, notes the progress report. In yesterday's New York Times, conservative columnist David Brooks lavished praise on the White House, pointing to a change burbling in Beirut, with many young people proudly hoisting the Lebanese flag in a country that was once a symbol of tribal factionalism. Of course, that same day, the country that was once a symbol of tribal factionalism became a country actually beset by factionalism as hundreds of thousands of pro-Syrian protesters poured into central Beirut Square. Now, this is a whole lot more people showed up yesterday for the pro-Syria rallies than showed up the day before for the Get Syria Out rally. So go figure. We don't know what's going to go on there. And we have to be very, very careful about this. George is running around going, look at this, Saudi Arabia, they're actually having elections. Yes, in one city, Riyadh, and women weren't allowed to vote. This is not like it's a big deal. This is like as if in the 1940s, in some suburb of Birmingham, they'd allowed five blacks to vote, and then all the segregationists had said, hey, look at that, well, we're making progress here. Come on. At the same time, we've lost 1,500 soldiers. We've killed 100,000 innocent Iraqis. That's excluding battlefield deaths. 100,000 human beings dead. We're bringing home our wounded now under cover of darkness. They're smuggling them in, too, so just like with the coffins, so that we don't see them. And the world is looking at us and going, what? This is the beacon of democracy. They're taking prisoners and sending them to Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Syria to be tortured. I mean, it's just this is. I'm sorry. I can't give George any credit for this. This is happening despite his efforts, not because of them. Very straightforward. 1-866-889. By the way, our telephone number 889-8894. Mark in Tennessee on the line. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. I hate to get off topic, but I'm trying to get back to something else.
That's fine.
The 106-page memorandum of talking points for the 2006 election.
From Frank Luntz.
It kind of dropped out of everybody.
Yeah.
They're not talking about it anymore.
I know.
I've been trying to get a copy of it so I can disseminate it to all these right-wing people that I'm trying to talk to and show them how they've been duped.
Yeah.
And how they're going to be duped in 2006.
Well, if you go to our message boards, there's a couple of folks there who have posted links to it, to the PDF, and you can download it and print it.
Well, I really need that. And
yeah.
And you're right about Bush. you are so right. I love your rant, and... He's really selling us down the wrong road.
There you go. Mark, well said. Thanks a lot for the call. And just go to TomHartman.com and click on message boards, and it'll take you to a place where you can get the link for the Frank Luntz memos. And I agree, it needs more publicity. It really does. But the conservative corporate media just didn't want to touch it. 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Gotta do what you can just to keep your love alive. Try not to confuse you with what you do to survive. Just tonight I was 21 when I called the road my own.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Interesting conversation in our chat room right now, which you can get to by going to TomHartmann.com, click live chat, about mortgage payments, credit cards. How do you get credit if you don't want to have credit cards, things like that? We'll talk about that a little bit after the break. And it fits right in with Florida's right-wing anti-democracy movement. You've got to hear about what's going on in Florida with regard to the minimum wage and Jeb Bush and all that. But first, let's hear from Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, it also fits right in with some information that Fulton News is reporting today that Visa USA, as you know, they're the people with Visa, are trying now to put more deep roots by hiring more Republicans in their Washington office, including the somebody who worked formerly for Newt Gingrich and GOPAC. So they are really trying to put whatever they can do to make sure that they have their roots in terms of lobbying. And, of course, this directly affects the bankruptcy bill.
Yeah, so they're playing the same game the pharmaceutical companies did. They just hired Billy Towson for, what, $2 million a year or something like that?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, what's
surprise,
really
surprise, Ellen.
I had run into Congressman Jerry Nadler. Oh, it wasn't immediately. It was a few months ago. And when this bankruptcy bill was sort of starting to gain steam, and I said, what is with it? Why are some of the Democrats voting for this?
Yeah.
And he rubs his little fingers together, you know, the nonverbal for money.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Ellen, I have never in all my life seen so much money for lobbying for anything on Capitol Hill as the bankruptcy bill.
Yeah, well, when you think of it, politicians are actually a fairly cheap investment. You invest a few million or even a few tens of million, and you make billions. I mean, I'd love to have that kind of an investment, wouldn't you?
I would. So that's the Visa thing is very interesting. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that Chuck Schumer is going to have a press conference this afternoon, and he is going to call on President Bush to use the Strategic Petroleum Reserve because gasoline prices in May are expected to peak at about $2.15 per gallon at just the regular pump.
Yeah, see, that's where I would disagree with Chuck Schumer. I think that we, you know, as long as what we need to be doing is we need to do away with the $100,000 tax exemption if you buy a vehicle that weighs more than 6,000 pounds. If you buy a Hummer right now or a Land Rover or any one of these giant SUVs that weighs more than 6,001 pounds, you can take $100,000 off your income taxes if you have a small company. And there's, you know, millions of them out there. If you've got,
well, he's also doing nothing in his environment bill, his energy bill, to protect the environment by developing new technology.
Right. So I think
he's got like $20 million for hydrogen cars. Well, $20 million,
it's nothing.
Won't buy you, you know, five scientists in a lab.
Right. It's nothing. And this is why I frankly, you know, as much as I sympathize with the truck drivers who make their living, and this is going to hit them badly. And what they need, we need to go back to regulation in the trucking field to solve that problem, and heavy unionization. But by and large, I think that, you know, higher gasoline prices, I mean, they certainly have helped Europe. The average European uses 1/7 as much oil per capita as we do because it costs $5.50 a gallon for gas there.
Well, but they also have better public transportation, train system. We are trying to get rid of.
You know why? Because gas is more expensive.
$1 million subsidy.
Yeah, and that's because gas is more expensive. So I disagree with Schumer on this. Anything that's going to lower gas prices, in my mind, is going to make global warming worse and is going to prolong the energy crisis. So even though he's a Democrat, I'd respectfully disagree with him. It's probably going to be a very politically popular position, though. You know,
and one other thing, labor is now trying to raise $30 million to fight Bush on Social Security, and they are trying to do radio television ads. They're going to try and fund some TV and radio ads. They're really going to go at it full time, particularly the state and county and municipal employees.
That's great. And let's remind folks that the AFL-CIO.org website, they have this new, even if you're not a member, a union member, America Works, I think, is website. And you can contribute. You can participate in these efforts. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks so much for the update today.
Thank you.
29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. When you move in,
get George, if I had to get up on stage with George W., it would be the creepy crawly chills, I got to tell you. Welcome back to our program, 27 minutes before the hour. My old friend and business partner, Nigel Peacock, just dropped into our chat room from just outside London, living by the 100-acre wood. Hello, Nigel. And greetings to everybody else in the chat room. In fact, you can get there by going to TomHartmann.com, click live chat. 26 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to call in. And, in fact, Steve in Atlanta is on the line. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good talking to you. I'm the blueberry down here in the South and a big bowl of tomato soup.
Well, there's a lot of you down there, Steve. I used to live in Atlanta.
Well, you know our legislature went red, Tom.
Really?
Say, well, yeah. Man, you should see these bills they're passing, this Secrecy and Government Act that finally got tabled and everything.
Well, you can kind of track it back to Georgia was one of the first states to have electronic voting machines where there's no paper trail, no audit.
Yep, and thanks to Kathy Cox.
Yeah, and all of a sudden the exit polls are showing Max Cleland won, the pre-exit polls are showing Max Cleland won, and Max Cleland lost by the exact same margin he was supposed to win by. Go figure.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I'm looking for a voter group, to join, and I found Common Cause of Georgia, and I look on their website, and it's like, the voting machines, here in Georgia are okay, they're okay. And I'm like, what is up with this?
Yeah.
And so I talked to some other group, and they said that Kathy Cox is a member of that Common Cause of Georgia, and that's probably why they feel that way.
I would, have you looked into Democracy for America?
Well, we got a bill there was an article in the paper yesterday. There is a bill in the House now about getting paper receipts. And so, wish us luck.
Yeah, let's hope it's more than just cosmetic.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind, Steve?
Well, a caller last hour resonated some with me, and that was, how hard, I've been, since the last election, really trying to pay attention to politics, do what I can, and he mentioned it's just so hard to really keep up with everything, being, I'm the working father, my wife stays home with the kids and everything, so it's so hard to keep up with. And I was wondering what we need is somehow at the end of a session, a legislative session, a summary of all the bills, that not only became law, but maybe they were also voted down. It was the arguments for and against them, bipartisan, as well as who voted for them. Yeah, do you know of anything like that?
Well, that was the original rationale for Thomas. Are you familiar with the Thomas system that came out of the federal government? It used to have its own website, and it was something like thomas.gov. And now I think it's thomas.house.gov or something like that. If you do a Google search on Thomas and House of Representatives or something, and it was named after Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be, and it actually was for a brief time during the Clinton administration, it was a summary of what's before the legislature, what's before the House, what's before the Senate,
mm-hmm.
what are the details, who's voting how, what are people's individual voting records, entirely nonpartisan. I mean, it's just done by bureaucrats who work for Congress. They're not party hacks or anything. They're like the professional, they're there regardless of the administration folks.
Mm-hmm.
And my recollection, my belief is that it was during the Bush administration that it got essentially – got its knees cut out. It just got chopped down to being simply a kind of secondary reference service. But I agree, there is a terrible need for something like that.
Because you miss a couple of newspapers, each day, and you go back to look at it the next day, and you feel like you've lost everything.
Well, and not only that, I mean, even worse than that is that if you watch network television, you watch the news, and even the cable news, most of the commentary on most of these bills that you see and hear, most of the commentary is coming from right-wing think tanks, and they don't even identify them as right-wing think tanks anymore. They don't even, here's Cliff May from the Center for the Defense of Democracies. Oh, he must be a great guy, Center for Defense of Democracies. He's one of the most right-wing zealots in Washington, D.C. They never qualify that. Here's a guy from a lobbying group, USA Next. They don't say, it's essentially a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party.
I found that website yesterday.
Yeah, and they're the ones who are now they're trying to position themselves as the alternative to the AARP. Well, back when they were sponsoring the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, they were something else. But it's like, come on, guys, give us a break. And the cons are love to talk about the media filter, the liberal media filter and all. There is a media filter, and it's working to the benefit of and on behalf of corporate America, the transnational corporations. We're not talking about companies like, you know, little companies like you or I might start our own. We're talking about huge multinational corporations that are hustling as fast as they can to move their jobs to China and India.
Now, how can you prove that? Because I heard Ari Fleischer on our local sports radio station was on this morning. He was talking about the liberal bias.
Yeah, he's flogging his book.
I know he is. But how do you prove to that other person that there is the conservative slant to the media?
Well, you just ask them who owns the media.
Okay.
And, you know, their response to you will be, well, every study shows that about 60-70% of reporters actually identify themselves as being liberal or as being Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
The irony is that that's about the same as percentage as those people who have gone to university, to college.
How about that?
And it's just it's what happens. I mean, you get an education and you start understanding how politics work and how economics work, and suddenly the Republican Party doesn't make much sense. And, you know, but the reality is that the reporters are not the ones who are making the editorial decisions. They're not
right.
The ones who are making the final decisions on what gets cut and what doesn't. They're not the ones who are controlling this. No, it's these big corporations, and these reporters know which side their bread is buttered on. It's been 3.5 years since anybody asked a hard question of George W. Bush, and that was Helen Thomas in the first press conference, and she's been sitting in the back ever since.
Hey, I got a few things to talk about, but I'll call you tomorrow about the rest of them. But I
That's
do
okay.
have one question.
Sure.
Bush is going around the country.
By the way, let me interrupt you. There is a book called What Liberal Bias, and I'm forgetting who wrote it. I want to say it was Jeff Cohen Affair, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't. It might have been Eric Alterman. But it's called What Liberal Bias, and it takes apart Bernard Goldberg's book about liberal bias in the media and exposes in just excruciating and methodical detail, and it came out about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, in excruciating detail exposes the conservative bias of the mainstream media. And the title of the book is What Liberal Bias. You just plug it into Amazon or whatever, you'll find it pretty easily.
Check that out.
Yeah. So you were saying, anyway.
Yeah. Bush is going around his little whistle-stop tour, you know, touting Social Security, right?
Yeah.
Each stop is, you know, invitation only, I gather, right?
Not only is it invitation only, but there is a lobbying group, in quotes, you know, another one of these industry groups, that is traveling in buses around the country following him, constituting in some cases as much as a third of his audience, and usually the average folks who are up on the stage with him are coming from this group. I had the whole story on them either yesterday or the day before. I shared it on the air, and I don't have the paper in front of me, so I don't remember the name of the group, but... this is not just hand-picked local friendly folks. This is an audience full of ringers. This is an audience full of Jeff Gannons.
I wonder how that one lady got on stage. Remember that said, you know, I'm working three jobs. You know, Bush said that's fantastic.
Right. She was somebody's relative. She was just supposed to be. You know, they wanted to get. You know, she was actually not trying to attack him. She was still supportive of Bush. She was still, you know, a Republican. And you know what they do is they're trying to get the very best photo shot, right? So they look through the audience. I mean, there was a famous thing during the 2000 election where Bush made all the businessmen who showed up take off their ties, you know, and stick them in their coat pockets. And so all the guys standing behind him, in fact, many of them had to take off their sports coat or their suit coats so that they looked like, you know, working folks.
I gotcha.
And so they look around, they say, oh, there's a woman. She looks like an average working person. Bring her up on the stage. And, you know, and they're very flattered to be there. And he just wasn't expecting to get that response from her.
So my question is, since this is hand-picked, who's paying for this?
You and me.
Isn't this illegal?
Well, or
unethical, I guess, at the very least.
It's clearly unethical, and it is probably illegal. And it depends on how you define political activity and partisan activity. But at the very least, it's unseemly. But the fact of the matter is there have been about 50 major scandals. We're talking about things that could be felonies with regard to this administration, none of which have been investigated and won't be as long as Republicans control both the House and Senate.
And they're the ones telling the world how to run a democracy. You know, I just can't stand it.
Well, that's why Vlad Putin just laughed at us. I mean, that's why he held his press conference and he said, you know, we have a system that's sort of similar to your electoral college. And what he was saying was, hey, George, you know, Al Gore won the popular vote in 2000. What do you think you're doing calling yourself president?
Yeah.
And so.
Hey, thanks for the great show, Tom.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve, for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Last November, the voters of Florida went to the polls, reports the Center for American Progress. By an overwhelming majority, they passed a constitutional amendment. You can amend the Constitution in Florida, right? Because the legislature won't do it. because they're firmly in the pocket of the big corporations. Amending the state constitution to raise the minimum wage by a buck from $5.15 an hour to $6.15 an hour. And in today's newspaper, in my the local paper here, this is a Vermont newspaper, an article by Sean Banfield. Sean, and then, you know, at the end it says, Sean Banfield is a Vermont state director of the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB is the state and nation's largest small business advocacy group. They neglect to mention that there is a lot of very big corporations helping fund this thing. In any case, Sean Banfield says, and I quote, the Vermont legislature, see, this is the same thing that's going on in Florida. This is happening all over the country. The Vermont legislature is poised to enact legislation that will mandate a higher minimum wage. In doing so, lawmakers will automatically increase the operating costs for the state's small business community, threatening the very core of our state's economy. This is the argument the cons make. If you raise the minimum wage, you threaten our economy. Well, excuse me. If business is a game and we're setting the rules of the game, then it's entirely reasonable for us to say, hey, listen, if you can't run a business and pay a living wage to people, you have no business running a business. It's not a business we want in our society. We don't want this to be Charles Dickens' America. We don't want this to be Sweatshop Nation. Sorry. We the people have the right to say that. And historically, we have. Oh, but the cons say that you're restricting our economic freedom. I'm sorry. You're using our resources. You're using our commons. You're using the currency that we're paying for with our tax dollars. You're using the banking system that we're paying for with our tax dollars. You're using the court system to enforce your contracts that we're paying for with our state with our tax dollars. You're using the Secretary of State's office that we pay for with our tax dollars to create your corporation. You're using the commons, you're using the phone right away, you're using an educated workforce that comes from our public schools that we pay for. You are using our resources. We get to define the rules of business. And if we say, hey, listen, if you want to play the game of business, you're going to have to pay a living wage, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's the best thing for this country. Not only that, you're ignoring the rule, the law, the basic law of economics. If you pay people a decent living wage, those people are going to be at the bottom of the pay scale, which means 100% of their income is going to get spent. And when it gets spent, what's it going to do? It's going to create demand for more goods and services. And what's that going to do? It's going to cause more entrepreneurs to say, hey, there's demand here. I can make more product. And what's that going to do? It's going to create more jobs. But, the cons will say, it will cause inflation, what Greenspan calls wage inflation. Well, let's take a look at it. The minimum wage was first created in 1938. It was raised in 57, 63, and 96. In 1957, the inflation rate was 3.38%. They raised the minimum wage, and what happened the following year, 1958? The inflation rate dropped to 2.98%. The year after that, it dropped even farther down to a half a percent, 0.58%. And in the next 3 years, 1960, it was at 1.72%, 61, 1.13%, 1962, 1.12%. So in 1963, we raised the minimum wage again. And what happened to the inflation rate? It was at 1.10%. It fell again. The next year, 64, 1.37%. 1965, 1.62%. These are all less than it is right now. It's over 3% right now. In 66, it was up to 2.92%. 67, now see, we're seeing the effects of the Vietnam War starting up. 67, 2.48%. 68, now we're full tilt boogie into Vietnam. LBJ is trying to have guns and butter. The inflation rate got up to 4.26%, 1969, 5.29%. Now the inflation rate's going up, we're now 6 years away from an increase in the minimum wage. It had nothing to do with it. It was the Vietnam War that did it. Well, how about 1996? This was the last time the minimum wage was increased during Bill Clinton's administration, 1996. The inflation rate that year was 2.96%. We raised the minimum wage. The next year, did inflation go up? Nope, it went down. It went from 2.96% in 96 to 2.35% in 97. And the following year, it went down even farther. In 1998, it went down to 1.51%. In 1999, it was 2.21%, still below the rate that it was at 1996 when we raised the minimum wage. And yet these cons have the audacity to write these op-ed pieces that are run as a news story in my local newspaper. Legislation that has passed the Senate and is headed to the House would automatically increase the state's minimum wage based on the Consumer Price Index. If passed, this legislation eliminates a business owner's ability to control the direction of their business and redirects working capital that could have been reinvested in the business. How dare they? How dare they? And then the White House, to cover this stuff up. The National Security Council, I'll have to tell you after the break. This is just incredible. Editing the National Security Council's economic report. Now, this had to do with the economy in Iraq, but it's a variation on the exact same theme. We're going to tell you what we want to tell you is what they're saying. And the truth be damned, it's not about the truth. 10 minutes before the hour, on the True People's Radio, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls.
But
you're gonna have to serve somebody.
You gotta serve somebody, yeah.
Yes, indeed. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
It's a great song from Bob Dylan's Christian era. Yeah.
It may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
There you go. That's the kicker. Well, now the Republicans have turned that around. You know, you gotta serve somebody. It might be yourself, it might be democracy, it might be America, or it might be the multinational corporate taskmasters and their toadies in Congress all across the nation. Florida going through this same thing now. They're the Florida Retail Federation lobbying furiously to kill this amendment that the voters of Florida overwhelmingly voted for, to raise the minimum wage to $6.15 an hour. In the meantime, the National Security Council, this is from the OMB Watch, Office of Management and Budget Watch, National Security Council had an entire chapter on Iraq's economy deleted from the economic report of the president simply because it would interfere with the positive tone of the rest of the report. So it's all about cosmetics. It's not at all about reality here. The report is produced annually by the Council of Economic Advisers, a supposedly independent advisory entity. The unprecedented move is yet another example, says OMB Watch, of the Bush administration's willingness to manipulate expert and scientific information for political reasons. The missing chapter addresses the development of the Iraqi banking system, financial markets, and other economic institutions, or to be more accurate, the failure of the development of the Iraqi banking, financial, and economic institutions. The White House, OMB Watch notes, has downplayed the deleted chapter, explaining that it did not belong in a report on the American economy, except for the fact that we put $200 billion into this thing. Congress and the public, OMB Watch says, are entitled to a full and unbiased accounting from the CEA experts, but once again are given an incomplete and misleading picture. Thank you very much to the Bush administration. The CEA's report will be used to make and justify important decisions, including how the U.S. spends billions in Iraq. When the Bush administration filters information, speaking of filters, from independent experts and scientists, that information no longer belongs to those experts. It becomes the administration's opinion. Yeah. Everything's just fine in Iraq. Don't worry. Everything's just happy, happy, happy. is we'll just take our big black felt pen and mark out those parts of the report that we don't want you to know about. It's the Bushy way. The Bushevics are at it again. It's Tom Hartman here with you, where we run rings around the right wing every single day.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where in the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain. We're tuning in, and it's as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Where you will get your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Okay, enough of that stuff. Well, welcome back to our program. I'm Tom Hartman. Very glad to be here with you. The website, by the way, the caller in the previous hour who was asking, is there some place where you can get information about what's before government, what's going on? Thomas.loc.gov. No, do not put www in front of it. So it's http://thomas.loc, as in location, .gov, as in government. And that gets you to Thomas, which is this service that Congress has put together, which tells you all about the legislation and what's going on. And I want to get into what Florida, I want to wrap up this thing about what Florida is doing and what Howard Dean is doing now, and then, well, talk about the situation with oil, and boy, there's just so much in the news. But first, let's hear from Dave in Humboldt County. If you'd like to call in, our number, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Dave, how are you doing today?
Oh, very well, Tom, and yourself. You again began your program with a news bomb that I had hoped you'd get back to, and we're going to hear it nowhere else. It's like so many things.
The Teresa Heinz Kerry has said that the 2004 election was hacked, and that 80% of the voting machines are run by, she says owned by, I would say controlled by, two brothers who are hard right Republicans. Yeah.
Do you know the circumstances under which she did that, and did she indicate that she was speaking strictly for herself, or is that a view shared by any other family members?
It was only carried by one newspaper, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and I believe it was in the context of a trip that she had made to Seattle for on behalf of some charity or something. I'm going to have to go back and read the article carefully, because I just pulled that part of it out just before we went on the air.
You know, that would be newsworthy in a country that had a free press.
Well, here's what's interesting. The Drudge Report pointed to it for about an hour last night, and then it went away. And there have been a couple of other newspapers. If you Google it, if you go into the Google News part, you know, in the news service, and Google it, you'll find a couple of places where I think this is like maybe three newspapers now. In fact, the New York, I believe it's the Daily News today, quoted the Seattle paper, and basically said, "Oh my God, she's a crackpot. She's at it again." That was their take on it.
Uh-huh.
But it's not a story. I mean, this is a story that I think deserves national attention. When you have the wife of a candidate for president of the United States claiming that the election system is rigged, that's a big story.
It's clear to me that all of the media has been told they don't get to say anything about election fraud. I listen to all these news programs every weekend and whatnot on Sunday morning. You cannot mention election fraud.
Well, I do, at least three or four times a week, Dave.
You do.
Nobody has told me anything. So I'm telling you, nobody has said don't do it.
Yeah, you're a hard man to tell things to.
Well, there is that. But the fact of the matter is, I think it's one of those things like somebody in your family being an alcoholic or something and beating up their wife. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you just don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's too grim to know about. And I think that Americans are in denial about it. And we need to do something. We need to prepare for this eventuality in the 2006 election. We need to be preparing for it right now.
The main thing, because they still have those damn machines, and they're still not bringing in any bill to modify them.
Well, and the machines are only half the problem, Dave. You've also got partisans like Ken Blackwell in Ohio, mm-hmm. and Catherine Harris in Florida, who are able to purge voting rolls and delay mailing out absentee ballots and set up all kinds of little hoops that people have to jump through if they are absentee voters, and minimize the number of machines in minority districts and maximize the number of machines, you know, even if they're optical scan machines, even if it's just paper ballot, maximize the number of options for people who want to vote in areas that are primarily going to be Republican. I mean, election fraud is not just one thing. There's a whole series of games, and they're
a lot of
and they're
ways
not,
they do it.
That's right, and they're not games that are just for the Republican Party. Although, ironically, in this last election, it's virtually every single case that has been found where, oh gee, there was a machine glitch. Oh gee, they had to bring in a new chip. Oh gee, we found it. You know, there was an error. Oh gee, some group came in and they were having people sign up and actually changing their party. All of them. With the exception of one race in South Carolina or something, with one single exception that I know of, all of them have broken to the advantage of George W. Bush. Now, that is a statistical anomaly of mind-boggling proportions in my mind.
They had a plan, and they implemented it. You know, only on your program did I hear of all these math professors that retabulated the exit polls versus the machines and learned of an 8 million shift of votes from Bush to Kerry. And nowhere can I find that. I can't, you know, just nobody thinks that's worthy of news.
Yeah. Well, see, I think this is worthy of news. I think it's worthy of news not because I'm a partisan Democrat, because I'm not. I have a lot of problems with the Democratic Party, but because it's not healthy for democracy. I would think that both parties would want to have a system that has electoral integrity. And it alarms me that one of the two parties in power, and the one that actually has the most power, is opposed to an electoral system that has integrity and transparency. That concerns me, and I'd like to know why. And nobody's getting straight answers from these folks. Dave, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. But this is an issue that I would think should concern all Americans. I don't understand why right wing sites like Newsmax aren't writing about this. You know, it's number 12 taxi driver number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, number 12, listening to us on KRSN. I hope.
Yes, I am actually.
Great. What's up?
It's biblical, you know, in the last book of the thing called the Bible, they don't call that thing the beast for nothing.
Yeah.
I really think what we're experiencing now with like identity theft and stolen elections and all that kind of stuff is just sort of like a primordial ooze of what's to come as far as technology goes.
Yeah. You almost wonder if Revelation was, you know, literally God speaking, or if it was John, you know, Carl Jung would have said in all probability that it was John projecting the collective unconscious, that it was basically a fairly accurate kind of prediction of what happens when human nature runs amok. And here we are.
Like basically technology, or I think, you know, Lucifer's term for it would have been, or God's term would have been, the knowledge of good and evil, which is the basis of science, which is the basis of technology, because I think that the devil knew that this would be man's undoing or his downfall. It would be a Terminator scenario in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, and it's not like we haven't made a few movies about it.
No, we haven't. It's not like, yeah, you're right. It's not like we haven't written a few books about it either.
There you go, 1984 and so on. And what just absolutely amazes me is that why is it that Teresa is talking about this? Why isn't John talking about it? Why aren't the Democrats and why aren't the Republicans talking about this? Why aren't they concerned about this? You've got a corrupt system. You know, God bless John McCain. He speaks out about these things from time to time, although he has even been reluctant to talk about voting machines. And look at the hit he took in South Carolina when George W. took him down in 2000. I mean, in ways that I think were criminal, that violated campaign laws. But in any case, I'm sure that's not what you called to talk about, or was it?
No, I just I really think the corruption and human evil is like the rain, and it falls on all things equally, and it really does not discriminate.
Yeah. Yeah,
when it comes right down to it, you know, party affiliation is just a way to divide and conquer for the people that pull the strings of these parties.
To a large extent, I would agree with you. And we need to go back to a system where we have parties that actually represent specific constituencies other than corporations.
And decentralize the power structure somehow. I don't know how.
Yeah, well, you know, the way to do it, Jefferson wrote about this at length, about the ward system and how important it was that we always maintain active local political politics and keep as much power as possible, political power as possible, on the local level. And that has been the conservative mantra for years and years, although it also was one of the things that Roosevelt was in favor of. I mean, this is not, I don't think that this is a partisan thing, frankly. I think this is a pro-democracy thing. And this is one of the areas where I had, there's not a lot of disagreement between, I think, you know, true liberals and true, or progressives or whatever, and true conservatives. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of true conservatives, and there's a startling few number of true liberals or progressives out there. All we've got are partisans. Everybody's my team, your team. And
the partisan thing is the undoing, because it's the old cliche of divide and conquer. And even if you're not religious, go back to that book and just read Revelation 13:16, because it says specifically the only thing you can do is you can't buy or sell or own anything unless you have the mark of the beast.
Yeah, on your forehead.
Or on your hand, or the name of it. Basically, yeah. I think it's sort of we're gonna be turned into the credit card.
Yeah, well, you know, they've got these little chips they can implant in you.
I don't think it's gonna be a chip. I think it's gonna be something much more insidious, something you can't remove, like some sort of like semi DNA compatible liquid medium or something like
that. I'll bet it'll be a retinal scan.
It might be.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, they probably have cameras right now where they can catch a retinal scan from about 6 feet away, and you don't even know it's happened. And if they don't, they will soon.
Real quickly, in 1997 in CNN, I saw a very quick article that said that the silicon chip will outgrow its speed and usefulness by the year 2020, and the next generation of technology is going to be an encoded protein molecule in a liquid medium.
Right. Nanotechnology. It's coming. It's coming.
I really think that's going to be something to be very concerned about.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I wrote an article about soliton technology back in 1983 for Computer World magazine, for Popular Computing magazine. I used to write a column for them called High Technology. Yeah, it's coming. Number 12, thanks for the call. It's wonderful to hear from you. I'm so glad that we're back on the air in Santa Fe and Los Alamos there on KRSN, and our listeners are coming back. Thanks so much for the call. Florida's right-wing anti-democracy move. I just want to wrap this up because this is really quite startling here. Last November, this was, you know, during the last election, the voters of Florida turned out in record numbers and voted to raise the minimum wage by amending their constitution. And now we've got a bunch of anti-democratic right-wingers in the Florida legislature furiously working to undermine the voters' intent. The group, this from the Center for American Progress, group led by Florida House Judiciary Chairman David Simmons, is pushing a bill that, quote, creates loopholes for employers and eliminates vital protections for workers, end quote. Simmons got help writing the bill from the Florida Retail Federation, which lobbied furiously last year to kill this minimum wage amendment. Now, the bill is being pushed by Simmons, requires employees to provide their employers 15 days notice before suing for a minimum wage dispute. It's like, hey, you broke the law. I'm giving you 15 days advance notice before I turn you in. If the employer pays the back wages during that time, there can be no suit. Well, this is great. You know, and this is the Retail Association. Well, why don't we just turn it around? If you go into a retail store and you steal something, you shoplift something, and they catch you, you have 15 days to return it. And there will be no charges against you. Hey, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, isn't it? 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
They gave up the old Bible Belt ballyhoo. You bamboozled them. Forget your AWOL and your DUI.
Razzle dazzle them, George.
You gave them a show that only
always pleases. Your friends claim you were endorsed by Jesus. You're razzle-dazzle-dum, razzle-dazzle-dum, razzle-dazzle-dum. And made sane people cry.
And welcome back. 25 minutes after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Here in Florida now, this bill, employers, if an employer breaks the law, they have 15 days to make it right or you can't turn them in. But if the employee breaks the law, you can nail our butts to the wall that day. Simmons says, Florida Retail Association, employer should not be punished for not ignores the employee's complaining for 15 days. And as soon as filed, Simmons' bill insulates the employer from any significant penalty. Employees would be prevented from receiving any interest on unpaid wages. Punitive damages or money for pain and suffering are all limited. The amendment approved by 70% of Florida voters specifically asked for that, for relief as may be appropriate to remedy the violation. But no, that's not what the members of the legislature. And now we got Jeb Bush. While his allies in the Florida House work to undermine the minimum wage, Governor Jeb Bush has proposed repealing a tax on wealthy investors. Calling the people who will benefit wealthy investors may be a bit of an understatement. The so-called intangibles tax, which Jeb Bush wants to repeal, only affects you if you are a married couple filing jointly and you have more than $560,000. Oh, welcome to the program.
Great show as always, Tom.
Thank you.
Hey, I'd like to go back to the retinal eye scan.
Yeah.
For a moment. Call me over paranoid, but when I bought a 2000 Yukon Denali, I got the OnStar system with it. And shortly after I had it, after the 1 year free trial, I discovered I was unable to disconnect that system. In fact, no dealer would have any part of disconnecting it. The other thing that I noticed, I don't know if anybody
hang on just a second, Dale. Why?
They would never give me an answer, Tom.
You're kidding.
No.
Well, I'm guessing that the reason why is because the system probably has a security feature built into
right.
it so that if your car is being stolen and you try and disconnect it, it's got some little battery in it and it sends off the signal going, oh, my God, I'm being disconnected. Somebody do something. And you probably have to go to the OnStar people and pay them to disconnect it or something
well,
like that. It's probably more about money than about Big Brother is my guess.
Well, even though I never did agree to make any kind of payments, to this day, you know, 3 or 4 years later, I still can push the OnStar and get service. But one other issue that I've noticed, and maybe I'm just becoming over-paranoid, but if you look real close on the rearview mirrors, talking about the retinal scan,
right.
There's a small little conchoidal kind of a dot, looks to be almost one of those smoke glass.
Yeah, it's like a little window.
Windows
yeah.
that's in it. And interestingly enough, when you turn the mirror, it has to be facing you. It looks to me like that would make an ideal way to get a retinal scan.
Well, it could be. I think that what that is that's where enough light gets into the back of the mirror for these mirrors that automatically adjust themselves to the amount of ambient light to know how much reflectivity to have. I think that that's just a mechanical thing. But I'm not saying that you are unjustified in being paranoid, Dale. Because I mean, consider what these giant corporations like Choice Point are doing
sure.
with our private information. It's like we are in 1984. It may not be in our rearview mirrors yet, but we are there. Dale, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
Now here's the good news. The Democratic National Committee raised $3.4 million in 3 weeks, more than double the amount. This is from an article by Will Lester in the Associated Press. More than double the amount raised during the same time in 2001. After George Bush was first selected, the new Democratic chairman said Monday, Chairman Howard Dean is working to keep Democrats competitive with the National Republican Party. a party that had a 6-to-1 cash advantage at the beginning of February. In January, the GOP raised $10.5 million. The DNC, $3.4 million. Dean says, we're just delighted. The fundraising is going better than we dared to hope. We just haven't put out an internet solicitation yet. So, step by step. Again, I believe that we need to have a strong Democratic Party. I believe we need to have a strong Green Party, too. Progressives, libertarians, all of them. We need more Americans involved in our political process. And I believe we need a strong Republican Party answerable to its human base, not its corporate base. I have no problem at all. In fact, I have great respect for the old-fashioned Barry Goldwater, Everett Dirksen, John McCain Republicans. I don't agree with them on most things, but I respect them. But these corporate whores, and I say that, you know, with an apology to prostitutes, like Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert and Bill Frist, are giving all the Republicans a bad name. It's just an absolute, not to mention George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Clear Skies Initiative. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Elaine in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Elaine, welcome to the program.
Yes, good old Humboldt County in Eureka, California.
Yes,
a wonderful
indeed.
Place to live, but oh. I wanted to call and make the rest of the country feel good today.
Okay.
You know what our lowest price for a gallon of gas is, and we can only get it at Costco, is $2.30.
Oh, my goodness.
The stations, other than that in the county, are charging anywhere from $2.46, I believe it was yesterday, to almost $2.70.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Elaine, this is just the beginning. Let me just share with you this from the Anandolo News Agency, which is where you have to get news about Hugo Chavez from Venezuela. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has announced that low oil prices are a thing of the past, and asked everyone to be ready for high prices. And then the OPEC Secretary General Adnan Shabi Eklin made an announcement 3 days ago that oil prices might increase to $80 a barrel within the next 2 years. So it's not going to go down. So it's time to buy a fuel-efficient car.
Well, that may help a little bit if you're able to do that. But yeah. A lot of us are, I'm 78, and I cannot go out and buy a new car.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
And then we have the other little deal here. I called and told you when the Chinese bought the pulp mill.
Uh-huh.
So now we have Evergreen Pulp in service here in Eureka and owned by the country of China.
Well, you know why? Mm-hmm. Because we're essentially giving them all our money in exchange for their trinkets so that we can buy junk at Walmart. And they have to buy something with that money here because it's U.S. dollars. And so they're buying our companies. They're buying our land. They're buying our forests. They're buying our...
Why is the government allowing it?
The government has no choice in the matter. The government actually has set up the situation. This goes back to trade policies that started aggressively under the Reagan administration, were pushed very hard by the Bush senior administration, were really elevated to an art form during the Clinton administration with GATT and NAFTA, and now are just being aggressively. I mean, now you got George W. Bush's former trade secretary trade representative saying outsourcing is a good thing. Right.
It depends on how many millions you have, I guess.
Yes.
But,
yes. It's very much. They have very much brought us a rich get richer and poor get poorer world, and they think that's just fine. They think that's going to make for a more stable America. I mean, in their heart of hearts, they really believe that that will make for a more stable country.
Well, I'll tell you from a personal standpoint, I'm not really afraid of Bin Laden, but I am of George W. Bush and his administration.
Yeah, well said, Elaine. Elaine, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you there in California, and thanks for listening to us on KGOE. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Ed in California. Hey, Ed, where in California today?
Oh, we're in San Juan, down south, just by your San Diego. But the sun went behind a big cloud today, so we're all depressed.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, it's terrible.
Life is rough.
But I want to let you in on a new thing. If they buy those energy-conscious cars, they're going to have to raise our taxes by putting stuff in the car that we just pay.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, they want to tax us for the amount that we drive. you know, the little monitor in your car, you drive it in, you pay extra taxes because you've how many miles you put on your car.
Right, yeah.
Well, I've got a new company. Please help me. What I want to do is eliminate most policemen. In that car with that thing is we put a gadget that every time you go fast, it gives you a ticket. Every time you go, you run through a red light, it gives you a ticket. See, so you don't have policemen anymore, and you just drive up once a month and pay your tickets.
Yes, it's...
I think it's a godsend.
Oh, yeah, it's a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea. Ed.
What are you laughing for?
I'm so...
You know they're going to do it.
I'm laughing at the irony. I mean, it is so tragic, frankly, that we are coming to these kinds of things in this country, that 1984 is here. And you know, Ed, you and I could be having this conversation on the most conservative talk show in this country just as easily as on the most liberal. These are issues that absolutely transcend labels.
Maybe that's where I'll go to get my money, to make this new thing.
Yeah, there you go. Ed, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. You too. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jim in New England on the line. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. This is John.
Hi. Oh, John. I'm sorry. I wrote it down wrong.
That's okay. I called. You were just mentioning about all Americans getting involved in the governmental process.
Yes.
Well, you know, here in Massachusetts, they've taken civics out of the schools. They don't teach that anymore.
I know it's happening all over the country, and it's because it's not part of the standardized testing mandated by No Child Left Behind.
That is so ridiculous.
They would just as soon our children know nothing about the history of the United States.
That's the foundation of this country.
Well,
and, you know,
that's why they don't want them to know about it.
Oh, this is pathetic. Oh, at least I knew who my governor was and who the lieutenant governor and everybody else and how a person should act in a civil society and that sort of thing. It's just pathetic.
John, about 2 months ago, they did a survey of high school seniors, and they asked them if they thought that the government should censor newspapers before they're published, or if it was an acceptable thing, if it was happening, and if so, if it was okay. And about half said they thought it was already happening, and two-thirds said it was just fine with them.
Tom, we're in a crisis here in this country. We're losing it.
We are. We're losing our roots. We are losing our connection to our heritage. We are losing our connection to our history, and we need to be bringing it back. And you don't bring it back with right wing or, for that matter, left wing talking points. You bring it back with real intelligence, serious entertainment. Fine, yeah, I believe this is a fairly entertaining radio program, but we also need to be talking about what's really going on in the world.
We've got to take to the streets. I keep saying it.
Well, long before people take to the streets, you have to inspire their minds, you have to awaken their minds, and you have to fill their hearts.
Right.
And you're going to do that, you know, in the old-fashioned way, which pamphleteering and committees of correspondence. You're going to do that. Now we're seeing in the last election, 40% of Americans said that they got some information from the internet. Right, this is the new pamphleteering, and you know, the bloggers and whatnot. I mean, this is serious stuff, and we need to be playing a more active role in this on an ongoing basis. This is why I keep writing for CommonDreams.org and for BuzzFlash.org. They're great sites, and I want to support them, and I want to use them to get the word out. And all of us need to be doing this. You know, create a blog or take things that you find and see an article you like and email it to all your friends. Start spamming your friends. You know, print things out, share them with people. And by the way, One of the reasons why our schools are so dumbed down in civics is because 25 years ago, Jerry Falwell and his moral majority set out on a campaign to get their people elected to school boards across the United States so that they could fight the teaching of evolution and birth control.
Oh, God.
And now we're reaping the results of that,
yeah,
and it's time.
I see that.
So, you know, run for the school board, John.
Well, maybe I will.
Yeah,
thanks a lot, Tom.
Okay, thanks, John. I appreciate it. I mean, see, this is the thing. We've got to get active. It's not enough to just sit around and say, oh, it's a terrible situation. It's just awful. We do need to point those things out, but we must get active. If you want a democracy, demos, it's the Greek word for the people. The people have to be active. Democracy is not a passive word. Speaking of Venezuela saying that the prices of oil are going up, this from Reuters, back off or suffer oil shock. The Iranian government in Tehran has issued a warning to the Bush administration. This also probably something you didn't hear about on the CBS, ABC, NBC, GE corporate news. Oil-rich Iran has raised the stakes in the standoff over its nuclear program, warning that any attempt to impose sanctions on its activities would lead to an energy crisis in the U.S. and Europe. Have you noticed that all of a sudden we've stopped talking about Iran and now we're talking about Syria? Now you know why. Referring the Islamist state to the United Nations Security Council, as the U.S. had urged, would be, quote, playing with fire, end quote, Iran's top nuclear official said yesterday. Hassan Rouhani said at a Tehran conference on nuclear technology and sustainable development, and I quote, the first to suffer will be Europe and the U.S. themselves. It would cause problems for the regional energy market, for the European economy, and even more so for the United States. Uh-oh. So, George, I predict you are going to see a lot less saber-rattling language. Now, this statement was actually made a couple of days ago. It took a while to work its way into the media. And, in fact, I got this out of an Australian newspaper called The Australian, which is one of the national newspapers in Australia. So here's the Australian perspective. U.S. President George W. Bush has also refused to rule out military action against Iran, the second biggest oil producer after Saudi Arabia in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. You get that? Number two in OPEC is Iran. And Iran is saying, mess with us. Shoot us. You shoot yourself in the foot. If Washington did not take the matter to the United Nations, Mr. Rouhani said yesterday, Iran would, quote, retract all the decisions it has made in the confidence building. Oh, if we did take the matter to the UN, Iran would retract all the decisions it's made and the confidence building measures it has taken. In other words, they're not going to put up with inspections. They're not going to, you know, whatever. And furthermore, he adds, the stability in the region would become fragile and the U.S. would be the first to suffer. Somehow when George W. threatens and acts tough and, you know, he's a cowboy, he's a man's man, somehow when that happens, it gets a lot of press in the corporate media in America, the corporate Republican media. But when another country pushes back, we don't hear much about it. Which reminds me, I was surfing yesterday through some of these right-wing websites. It's really interesting. Check this out. I mean, you just have to check this out. This is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. You go to the left-wing sites, and like BuzzFlash.com, for example, the way that this website supports itself is by selling books. And there are the books on democracy, I do a book review for them every month, and the book that I'm recommending right now is Dag Hammarskjöld's Markings, which is a spiritual diary. It's a book about religion or about personal mysticism. They sell books. CommonDreams.org, the website is supported by contributions. You go to the right-wing websites, and down both sides there are all these ads, but what's fascinating is what the ads are for. The ads are for male enhancement, martial arts, how to pump up your body, how to have big pecs and abs that, you know, look like a washboard. You see some of the pictures. I mean, it's almost like Jeff Gannon is modeling for some of these pictures. How to be a man's man. Yeah, it was really quite startling. I visited several of these right-wing websites, and they all seem to have the same ads, the same advertisers. Apparently, these advertisers have figured out that the people who read the conservative websites are concerned about the men who read it are concerned about the size of their apparatus and whether their muscles are big enough. Oh, and how to pick up girls. That's a big one. The big banner ad across the top, seduction techniques. And whether you're tough enough, and pheromone-containing perfumes or colognes, you know, that will cause women to swoon. because it contains these hormones that get them, make them all crazy, and they don't even know why. I'm telling you, this is absolutely fascinating. This is a, there's a sociological phenomena here. This is something worthy of examination. Just check it out. Go to some of the right-wing websites. Just type conservative news into Google and look at some of the websites. I don't want to name them specifically, frankly, but it's, you'll see it all across them. And it's like, they're not like, you know, well, occasionally there's an ad for Ann Coulter's book, and of course there's some speculation about Ann's gender history, but that's a whole other topic. But it's just, it's absolutely amazing. It's you know, what is the deal with the folks who are reading the right-wing websites? It's a, they have to be the most insecure men on the planet. And it's all about anger and paranoia. It's just fascinating, you know. With or without my psychotherapist hat on, I find it fascinating. Just another human being. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's close.
It's time to close up shop, George W. 2006 is coming.
They're romantic and satellites with acid and the Holy Spirit's crying, where's the beef? And the moon is swimming naked and the summer night is fragrant with a mighty expectation of relief.
Amazing.
So we struggle and we stagger down the snakes and up the ladder to the tower where the blessed hours chant. Then I swear it happened just like this, a sigh, a cry, a hungry kiss. The gates of love, they buzz and inch. I can't say much has happened since the closing time.
And welcome back. That Leonard Cohen, of course, 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our number, and David in Baltimore, Maryland, on the line. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Just got a couple of quick thoughts about how to take back the country from these cons. First thing, as far as the voting machines, I think if the Democrats could possibly somehow convince the cons that they're going to hack the living bejesus out of the machines in 2006, that might encourage them to take another look at, you know, some of the legislation to make sure there's paper trails. And
yeah, what we need is for some Democratic hacker to get caught.
Yeah, exactly.
even if it's phony, even if it's staged, right?
Right.
Some you know, some guy, oh, I'm a Democratic and I hacked, you know, it's a, yeah,
right.
It's a,
right, and the other idea I had was, and I don't know how we'd get it passed, but every once in a while the subject of a constitutional amendment comes up, and I think we should pass a constitutional amendment that says that anybody running for public office should have to read this book that I'm almost finished with. It's called What Would Jefferson Do?
Oh, well, thank you for the shameless plug, David. It's
I love it. I've just been sitting, you know, I sit and read it and just... I just shake my head and think, you know, wow.
It was one of my favorite books to write. I've written uh-huh. nearly 30 books, and I have 14 or 15 books in print right now. And that was one of the most fun to write because I got to read. I spent 4 years. I read, you know, over 10,000 of Jefferson's personal letters, and just get inside
really
this guy's head, and he's brilliant.
Yeah.
So anyhow, you were saying.
Okay, I really enjoyed reading it, and I'm going to try and get as many folks as I know to get a copy, and who knows, maybe we'll change some minds.
Well, hopefully. Thanks a lot, David. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
All right, take care, Tom.
Thanks, you too. It's nice to hear, you know, plugging my book. By the way, We the People is also another one that was a lot of fun to put together. That's actually, it's a comic book, a 100-and-some-odd page comic book for adults. And it's got much of the same solid information that's in What Would Jefferson Do, but it's the kind of book you can leave around and anybody can pick it up and read it. Not to shamelessly hawk my own. I guess I am, so I'll stop at that point. Warren Buffett still warning us about our trade policies and a sharecropper society that we are setting ourselves up, or the Bush administration is setting us up for a disaster. The force feeding of American wealth to the rest of the world. In the meantime, consumer debt raises to $2.12 trillion. Divide $2.12 trillion by 300 million, the population of America, more or less. You get some pretty startling numbers here. We are in debt up to our eyeballs. And who's holding the debt? China. Saudi Arabia. Not exactly democratic countries. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.